putting a piano under such circumstance for such a long time might ultimately ruin it. Was it?
And I can't reveal all the secrets, but what I can say is they were aware that it was going to be open end. There was for maybe a chance that there was going to be rain, so there was a backup plan so that no damaged instruments.
Okay. Basically. So no animals were harmed, no pianos were damaged. Ultimately,
no pianos were damaged. Yes.
Und damit danke fürs Einschalten und herzlich willkommen zum Elbphilharmonie Talk. Ich bin Julika.
Ich bin Tom.
Und Tom, ich habe mich so gefreut, dass das tatsächlich geklappt hat, dass du den Pianisten Alexandre Kantorow für diese Folge vors Mikro gekriegt hast.
Ja, und das noch vor seinem großen ersten Solo-Recital im großen Saal der Elbphilharmonie. Also das war schon bemerkenswert. Aber klar, er ist Residenzkünstler in dieser Saison. Er wird eine ganze Reihe von weiteren Konzerten spielen. Und das ist sozusagen keine zwei Meinungen drüber, dass man mit Kantorow natürlich unbedingt im Podcast sprechen möchte.
Alexandre Kantorow ist 97 geboren, also jetzt gerade mal 27 Jahre alt, ist aber tatsächlich, also man übertreibt nicht, wenn man sagt Weltklasse, der absolute Superstar der Klavierwelt im Moment.
Ja, ich würde sagen, seit Trifonov der Name, der am stärksten und am schnellsten in die Höhe geschossen ist in diesen letzten paar Jahren.
Eigentlich spätestens seit 2019, als er diesen sehr wichtigen Klavierwettbewerb, den Tschaikowski-Wettbewerb gewonnen hat, richtig?
Ja, das war der Turning Point für ihn, würde ich sagen. Und es gibt seit Trifonov, glaube ich, keinen Pianisten, der so kometenhaft, also man sagt immer Komet, der Komet fällt ja, aber so kometenhaft aufgestiegen ist wie Alexandre Kantorow.
Und spätestens seit diesem Jahr, 2024, ist er ja auch außerhalb so der Klassik-Konzert-Bubble weltbekannt, weil er ja bei den Eröffnungsfeierlichkeiten in Paris zu den Olympischen Spielen gespielt hat.
Er hat vor einem Milliarden-Fernsehpublikum unter nicht ganz geklärten Umständen Jeu d'eau von Maurice Ravel gespielt, unter strömendem Regen in Paris auf einem Instrument, von dem er mir versichert hat, es hat keinen Schaden genommen. Ich weiß also nicht, aus welchem Material dieser Fernsehflügel war.
Durfte er aber auch alles nicht
Durfte
verraten.
Durfte er alles nicht sagen, weil er viele NDAs unterschreiben musste. Und trotzdem ihn anzusehen dabei, wie er das gespielt hat, dieser entrückte Blick in den verregneten Pariser Himmel und diese herrlich nach hinten gegelten Haare. Es war ein traumhaft schöner Anblick.
Das Besondere an ihm ist, finde ich, dass er, also eins von den besonderen Dingen an ihm ist, dass er so im persönlichen Kontakt wahnsinnig nett und unkompliziert ist, so abgesehen von diesem ganzen Weltruhm, eben einfach total nahbar und freundlich, fast kollegial.
Also wir das ist vielleicht die Freundlichkeit der Jugend. Hoffen wir, dass ihm das erhalten bleibt, so lange wie möglich. I don't know.
Wir kennen ihn ja jetzt auch tatsächlich schon ein paar Jahre. Er war in verschiedenen Formaten hier schon bei uns auf den Bühnen. Witzigerweise hat sich das eigentlich dann auch jedes Mal ergeben, dass wir ein kleines Videoprojekt mit ihm hatten, einmal so ein kürzeres Porträt, dann haben wir, als er hier Teil der Nachwuchsreihe Fastlane war, mit ihm so ein Fahrstuhl-Interview gemacht, das war Teil der Reihe und jetzt zum Schluss als letztes in unserer Musikvideoreihe Elbphilharmonie Sessions eben so ein aufwendigeres Video mit ihm im Flügellager bei uns produziert, das haben wir ziemlich auf den Kopf gestellt und da schick Lampen aufgehängt und so. Links können wir euch auch in die Shownotes packen, aber es war eben ganz witzig, weil er dann sagte, er freut sich so, dass wir jedes Mal, wenn er kommt, noch ein bisschen upgraden und immer ein bisschen mehr Aufwand betreiben. Und es hat ihm sichtlich einfach auch Spaß gemacht. Und
ja, wahrscheinlich ist die nächste Steigerungsform, einen Steinway aufs Dach zu bringen und ihn dort spielen zu lassen.
Oh, versprich nicht zu viel.
Nee, das ist jetzt so ein Vorschlag nur.
Also du hast ja das Konzert jetzt leider verpasst, aber man hat einfach das Gefühl, er ist ein wahnsinnig uneitler Musiker. Also er nimmt einfach die Sache total ernst und gibt sich in dem Moment total hin. Und das ist wirklich faszinierend.
Naja, und er hat ein gigantisch großes, schweres Programm gespielt und das ist schon beeindruckend. Also was da für eine physische Kraft und auch für eine Willenskraft dahinter steht und was für eine musikalische Durchdringung doch sehr unterschiedlicher Welten. Da kann man einfach nur wirklich sich verneigen und sagen, toll, toll, toll.
In der Zeitung stand am nächsten Morgen, es wären genug Töne für 2 Konzerte gewesen.
Glaube ich sofort.
Ja, eigentlich auch im Prinzip für 4 oder 6 Hände wahrscheinlich.
Ja.
Also unglaublich virtuos, halt so dieses Brahms, Liszt, Rachmaninow-Repertoire. Er wird ja auch oft als der wiedergeborene Liszt bezeichnet.
Ja, das ist eine Zuschreibung, die ihm auch gefällt. Da hat er gar keine Einwände dagegen. Das hat mich ein bisschen überrascht, weil ich dachte, es kann einem ja auch ein bisschen im Weg stehen. Vielleicht wäre man ja auch gerne der wiedergeborene Sohn so. Aber nein, er ist der wiedergeborene Franz Liszt. Was mich persönlich sehr berührt hat, ist, er hat ja bei dem Konzert mit, was war das für ein Orchester, da hat er ja eine Zugabe gespielt, eine Solo-Zugabe, Danny Boy. Und ich dachte,
das war mit den Münchnern jetzt
mit den Münchnern, genau, ja. mit Togan Zokiev. Und da hat er auch am Rachmaninow gespielt und als Zugabe Danny Boy, ist ein altes irisches Volkslied. Und ich dachte, verflixt, ich kenne irgendwie die Changes, was spielt er da bloß? Und dann habe ich ihm gesagt, du, das hat mich ein bisschen an Keith Jarrett erinnert. Und dann hat er, weißt du, das ist die Version, die Keith in Tokio gespielt hat. Das heißt, er hat also sozusagen, und da gibt es keine Noten von, er hat sich dann reingeschafft, natürlich gibt es die Changes und so, und dann hat er dieses ganze Stück rausgehört. Und dann dachte ich, ja, beim Hören dachte ich, ja, das ist auch eine Fortsetzung von Keith Jarrett und nicht nur von Franz Liszt, die da bei ihm passiert. Und das fand ich sehr, sehr aufregend.
Gibt es übrigens auch noch im Livestream nachzuschauen,
ja, muss man an dieser Stelle sehen. Sagen. Das ist großartig.
Und jetzt bei dem Rezital im großen Saal, als er neulich dann da war, da hat er als letztes Stück ja dann nochmal was ganz, ganz anderes gespielt, nämlich Brahms' Bearbeitung von Bachs Chaconne aus der Partita eigentlich für Solovioline. Und Brahms hat die eben bearbeitet für ausschließlich die linke Hand. Also auch schon unglaublich. Und das war so bemerkenswert, weil er eben nach diesem wahnsinnig virtuosen, verschwenderischen Soloabend sich dann so reduziert hat auf diesen puren, sehr, sehr klaren, einfachen, konzentrierten Bach. Und das war ein ganz besonderer Moment im großen Saal, weil da einfach, ich meine, da sitzen 2000 Leute und halten den Atem an, weil er da sitzt auf dieser großen Bühne. Und einfach 18 Minuten lang, muss man dazu sagen.
Eben, es ist ja keine Miniatur.
Nur mit der linken Hand. Und das war, also es war wunderschön. Und ich war wirklich beeindruckt, wie er sich dann sozusagen so fokussieren konnte nochmal auf diese Klarheit, um dann letztlich im letzten Schritt für die Zugabe nochmal zurückzufinden zu Wagner und auch die rechte Hand zu reaktivieren für wiederum unglaublich viele Töne.
Ja. Also. Ja, das ist einfach, ich meine, diese Chaconne ist einfach groß, groß, große Musik und gleichzeitig hat es immer auch ein bisschen was Zuzensisches, wenn die Pianisten dann da ihre rechte Hand und dann Oberschenkel packen und anfangen, das wirklich alles mit der linken Hand zu spielen. Und
ja, manchmal hat er sich auch so am Flügel festgehalten mit der rechten Hand, wenn er so ganz große Sprünge links hatte, aber das war alles wahnsinnig unmittelbar.
Ja, ja, es ist vielleicht auch bloß nicht die Hand auf die Tasten zu bringen, packt man dann
irgendwo parken.
Die Zarge des Flügels um.
Ich freue mich sehr jedenfalls auf alle Konzerte, die da noch kommen. Gerade jetzt im Januar, wenn er dann mal umzieht in die Leihhalle.
Die Shownotes packen alle die
alle Konzerte packen wir auch in die Shownotes, ja, muss man, darf man nicht verpassen. Im Januar ist er in der Leihhalle, macht er Kammermusik. Das ist auch immer noch mal was ganz anderes, wenn man auch so besonders nah dran ist. Darauf freue ich mich wirklich auch wiederum Brahms. Also Musik, die ihm ganz besonders liegt und am Herzen liegt. Und dann ist er ja auch eben in der zweiten Saisonhälfte hier noch ein paar Mal im großen Saal. Also.
Ja, ja, Alexandre Kantorow ist einer dieser französischen Pianisten, die ein ganz besonderes Faible fürs deutsche Repertoire haben. Er spielt viel mehr deutsche Komponisten, also Brahms, Liszt. Liszt ist kein Deutscher, aber eben diese austro-ungarische, deutsche Klaviertradition ist ihm, glaube ich, fast noch ein Ideechen näher als diese schöne, schwelgerische französische Musik. Das ist sehr interessant.
Wobei er auch eben mit Saint-Saëns natürlich...
Einen habe ich dann auch gedacht, na gut, also einen Franzosen hat er dann auch im Programm.
Aber bevor wir jetzt abtauchen, ja, in die deutsch-französische Klaviermusikgeschichte, würde ich sagen, erstmal viel Spaß beim Hören.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
So super excited to be here with Alexandre Kantorow, the young, wonderful French pianist. And we just came through the lobby of the hotel and walked through the hall to get into the studio where we are recording. And I was wondering, maybe people will just recognize him and they want an autograph or a selfie with Alexandre.
What a disappointment.
I was wondering, I mean, you must be of some fame now. I mean, you have been playing in the Paris Olympics, yeah, the fameux jeu d'eau de Ravel, sous la pluie, literally, sous la pluie de Paris. And I think, I don't know, a billion people must have watched this at least.
Yes, probably, without realizing who I was. Also, I was very changed, lots of makeup and different hairstyles. I'm not even sure people can make the link between us two.
So the hair was combed all the way back.
Absolutely.
And maybe the rain did its little piece to it. And I just have to ask this before we go into some serious conversation here. Playing piano in the rain is insane in itself in a way, and of course it's something a once in a lifetime experience, I guess. How did it feel like having the fingers on this wet keyboard and still being able to accurately, did you rehearse like for all kinds of weathers?
I mean, we didn't rehearse for weathers in mind, but we had already prepared everything in order, so we but the rest was really a big surprise. We weren't allowed to know what was before, what was after. We didn't know what the set was going to look like. We knew only about our parts. And sometimes, you know, in summer when it's very hot, you sweat a lot. And even the piano, if it's very humid, you can even see condensation on the piano. And really, it's very slippery. But when you have this much rain, it's puddles. So it's not even sliding anymore. You just feel a.
It must be like swimming on the keyboard.
It's a bit like swimming, to be honest. But the whole, I don't know how to say it, the whole spirit of this night was kind of letting go of every preconceived notion or trying to be good or trying to look good. I felt the rain added this chaotic element where it was just a matter of keeping together and just giving without any notion of quality. It was, and so I felt that the spirit of friendship and of struggling against odds had really something unique to it, and I think a lot of artists felt it, and it helped a lot also with the pressure of the day. I feel really when we saw the rain on television for the first parts, there was a feeling of okay, we'll have to deal with it, and suddenly they didn't feel any pressure anymore.
And there was no pre-recording that was used, and you were just mimicking to play because
I can't reveal all the secrets of how it's done. I had a big contract.
I see. At least, I mean, it was wonderful, and I was of course also wondering what happened to the piano afterwards. I mean, putting a piano under such circumstance for such a long time might ultimately ruin it. Was it?
Yeah. Okay, again, I can't reveal all the secrets, but what I can say is they were aware that it was going to be open end. There was for maybe a chance that there was going to be rain, so there was a backup plan so that there's no damaged instruments,
okay.
Basically.
So no animals were harmed, no pianos
no
were damaged,
harmed,
ultimately.
No pianos were damaged, yes.
That's a good disclaimer. So this is the one Olympic game I should talk to you about. The other one, of course, is the Tchaikovsky competition, which happens to take place also every other 4 years, which is like the same rhythm the Olympic Games are.
That's true, yeah.
In odd years, though, because it started, I think, in 58 or so, and then
yes.
Maybe there were some
interruptions. There was a moment where it was 5 years, I think.
Yeah, there must have been a gap in between, mm-hmm. because the last one was in 2023, but yours was in 2019.
Yeah.
You were this super young, wonderful musician, and I've watched some of it yesterday again, just, you know, the replays and...
Yes.
You were 22 years old, and mm-hmm. you had this monster program of first round, second round. First silly, stupid question from a person who is not that much into the details of Tchaikovsky competition. Did the orchestra piece at the end still count as the third round, or was that already the reward for having been chosen?
Oh, no, that was the final round, the two concertos in final.
Okay, so there were still jurors watching
you. Yeah, there was jurors. We were seven, I think, for the final round, and normally there was supposed to be a Mozart concerto, but because they added the wins this year, the competition was very big, and so they cancelled in semifinals the Mozart with orchestra. So the only moments we had with orchestra was in the final rounds, where then we had the auto concertos back to back.
Incredible. And that was done within a period of 10 days, right?
Yes, it was all in a period of 10 days. It's very concentrated. And I know, for example, in Queen Elizabeth, it's nearly a month. And there's this whole week of residency where you learn a creation, a new piece. So this felt extremely condensed. And we were even all the foreigners packed in this hotel, just in across the hall, with two by rooms. Competitors, so it was.
You were even not alone in your
room. We were not even alone. So there was an atmosphere of just competition was there all the time.
And did you share the place with another pianist?
Yes, it was with another competitor. Yeah, but I was really lucky because it was. His name is Kenneth Branagh, and he. That's an actor, Kenneth Broberg, and he went into the final round with me also, and he had a third prize. So we had the joy
amiable
of sharing
kind of,
the whole competition together, and It helped a lot to alleviate the spirit.
But that's quite insane. I mean, playing all this wonderful music by heart. I mean, and you go into every piece, of course, with everything you are, with everything you have, and everything you've learned. And it's beautiful to see this on the video. You have a way of looking like to the ceiling of the hall and trying to close your eyes, open your eyes again. It's what are you waiting for in such moments?
Is it? It's very a difficult thing because I know I do things like opening, closing my eyes, but they are really unconscious. They are something that just happens with the music inside of you, and it's sort of It's sort of like bubbles you up, and sometimes then these gestures that appear to, that come because of the music, and you wouldn't do these gestures in the normal time or normal rehearsals. I think there's a I was lucky to do all the rounds I felt, because the first round I had concert experiences before, but the first round really felt challenging to get into the mood of a concert, to be able to just forget everything, forget the idea that you prepared this many months for this moment and that you had to give everything on that moment. I had really struggled with that on the first round, so I was really relieved that I had another shot at it afterwards, and I was lucky to experience more and more as the competition rounds went on, a feeling of getting less heavy mm-hmm. each time, mm-hmm. and being able to appreciate the hall, being you really feel that this is a mythical hall. This being Glenn Gould, this being who made this Van Cliburn before, who made really important concerts, so many that you've seen only from the eyes of the public, but never on stage. So yeah, I think there's a mixture of taking it all in that started to happen in the beginning and the end.
The competition took place in Moscow and in St. Petersburg, or did you go back and forth?
No, for us, the pianist, it was just Moscow, but we did the gala concert at the end in St. Petersburg.
Okay.
And I think it was just, I think maybe violin or cello and winds who were in St. Petersburg for the whole competition.
And all the pianists were in Moscow.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, in Moscow.
No, you know, I find it totally organic the way you behave, if I may say so, just before you start to play, because this is in whatever videos I see of yours, you mm-hmm. have this communion always, almost with some, I don't know what, force or energy, or with yourself, or going places, I don't know. But then you felt, even in the first round, it was as if you were at home somehow in this hall, you know?
Well, I'm happy because I think people have told me over the years that I feel always comfortable on stage, or I always make people feel that I am at ease. And sometimes it's really not the case, and it was really not the case. It's one of the points where I was really, I think, the most stressed. I felt the most like in an arena where you have to have this danger everywhere.
Bulls from all sides.
Yes, really. that's how I felt the first round. But that's also why we prepare this much for competitions, because unless you've done a lot of competitions, I think you don't know 100% what to expect, or the feeling of how it's going to be like. So that's why you need this preparation, so that even if you feel stressed or sick or had not slept the day before, there's a certain basis, there's a certain reflex where the music will still speak in your body and you'll be still able to produce something that can be organic and convincing, even if your mind is in a panic state. And I was thankful there for all the hours that my teacher spent with me before preparing really these rounds, because I understood why, really.
So this can't be only a pianistic preparation. It must also be the mindset. It must be physical. It must be all kinds of, you know, eventualities that you prevent or prepare for, mm-hmm. Just in case.
The thing is, we don't have, like in sports, a lot of knowledge about how to prepare mentally. And so we spend a lot of time preparing the competition, but I think probably all contestants that I've spoken with have this feeling of there's a mystery still of how the day is going to feel like. And some take more care of themselves, more body-wise, prepare with ideas of health, of mental structure, hygiene, everything. But there's always this big question mark before you enter in a competition. And the fact of spending this much time in an unfamiliar world or an unfamiliar place makes also that there's lots of things that you are going to happen that you probably have not even thought about, and it's part of it. And I think it's part of the life of a pianist to always constantly be in unfamiliar places. You never know the piano,
unfamiliar instruments. Yeah.
Exactly, you never know the piano, the acoustic, and so you have constantly these waves where you just have to find a natural way to prevent things and to deal with every new parameter that comes into your life.
Yeah, at least this is really, really amazing the way you did it. And you won the first prize and the, what was it?
The Grand Prix.
What's that exactly, the Grand Prix? Is it the audience reward? Or?
No, it's something that it's Valérie Gergiev who created it in 2011. It was the idea that you would give a big prize to out of all the instruments at the end of a competition. You would choose probably one and to give a Grand Prix, which would probably even help you more or shine a bit more light. And Trifonov was the first one to get it, and then it was a singer, and then it was me. And yes, it was a very unexpected moment. It happened after the gala of St. Petersburg, where we waited and we couldn't rehearse with Gergiev for the whole afternoon. So we rehearsed with his assistant, who wrote things in the score, and he came the last minute. And we had voices in the hall backstage just saying the people's names in the order they had to leave. We didn't know the order of before, so once I knew, okay, I wasn't the first to go, I wasn't in the middle, so I started thinking, okay, they will put me at the end, and the end was 1 or 2 in the morning. It was like a huge gala. And we did the last movement of Tchaikovsky Concerto, and just after that he just brought all the candidates and then announced in Russian the Grand Prix without that translation, so I didn't understand for a while. Oh. While people were just like, come and like take this, and I wasn't even aware of this
a little
price.
Embarrassing. And then,
and then I understood, and I realized what it really meant, and then it came with a sort of immediate joy and first concerts afterwards, where we didn't have even time to go home. There was already concerts booked for the winners, and we all went to different places in Europe, Finland, Germany to play, and then lots of things started from there.
I mean, you totally, totally merited this prize and every other prize. But I was asking myself briefly yesterday, maybe it was a little easier for the Russians to award you with all this because you have this Russian name, and it kind of was a coming home of the Tchaikovsky.
I sometimes imagine that they didn't realize that it was French, and at the last moment they said, "Oh no,
it's too late."
Too late. But no, actually, I think it was it's true this year. And since Valérie Gergiev took the competition, I think they really wanted to open up to the rest of the world.
Internationally,
there was Medici broadcast everywhere. And so there's this feeling of really like being open to all the other countries and making this recognition. So I actually felt that it was probably these years even more challenging for Russian candidates, because they felt really the pressure of Moscow Conservatory or St. Petersburg Conservatory to be the chosen ones to go to the competition. And I feel it was much more much more tense and much more weight that was on the shoulders of the Russian contestants from around the Moscow Conservatory than for us, who just came into an unknown place without understanding what was behind everything. So I would say it was probably lighter for us.
So it was even more of a reward than to be chosen as...
Oh, I think they just went with gut feeling, and that's it. But that's why I say I think on the psychological level it was probably even easier for us foreigners than for the Russian artists. And I think it's something you feel in their culture often. Yeah. They put a lot of weight on themselves.
Yeah, I see. What does that make with you as a pianist in terms of further competitions? Are you done with it now because you've made Tchaikovsky? I mean, there would be still Chopin probably.
you don't collect them as
no. That's the question. Trophies. You could say, okay, I have done my share, and I'm really up in there everywhere. No competition whatsoever.
Of course, I mean the goal of a competition is to really just make people notice you, and if a competition succeeds in doing that, really, then you should just let go the whole whole competition world. I think you, especially because you need the space for other people to be brought into light. And every competition, you get a new surprise and you get new people that are shown into the light. And that's really the most important thing, that we live in a world where we know that there are few places in the world like that where no matter what, you've got a chance. Mm-hmm. So no, I would. I was lucky that it happened in only this one competition. So of course not. It would be pointless, and I would risk much more by going into other competitions afterwards.
I see. That's also true. So of course, Kantarov, as I said, is a Russian name coming from your father's side, but he was already born in France.
Yes,
so he
that's
is
right,
like
yeah.
you are third generation non-Russian.
Yes, even four generations,
oh,
something like
more,
that.
Yeah, more. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And your father is this famous violinist and conductor, and of course this makes it very obvious that you grew up in this super musical household. No mentioning of your mother. What's her part in it?
I try and mention her, but it's true that my father was a big name in the classical world in France at the time. My mom is a violinist, and they met in Orchestre d'Auvergne, where my dad took his first conducting position mm-hmm, there.
Mm-hmm. And in the 60s or when was it? Or no, a little later.
Maybe 80s, probably 80s, yeah. Something like that. And yes, she really was the one that's actually... If my two parents were the musical world, but my dad was constantly going on tours, and my mom was really the one taking care of my education, not just musical, but just regular education, and the lack of discipline I had, and I like to go fast and understand fast, and I didn't want to go deep into anything. I just wanted to rush from superficial things to superficial things, even in music. What I loved was sight reading, not really in learning and going into the interpretation. And she really was the one to make me learn this discipline and to be there at my weekly lessons and to learn, manage a way so that I would practice and it would still feel enjoyable. And so, yeah, she was the one responsible for my whole first big part of life, which was learning and growing up in music.
Yeah. So she would definitely merit a mentioning in the Wikipedia
article. Yes, very much so.
So both violinists, though, was it an option for you to also play violin at first, or were you just so drawn to the piano that there was no two ways about it?
I'm happy because it turns out that I could, thanks to playing piano, play with my father in chamber music, and it would have probably been impossible with violin. I tried violin for just a few days when I was little, just enough to know that it was not for me.
Okay.
I think they tell me always the story that I had a small violin to start, and that the first day felt extremely natural, and they all thought, obviously,
enfant prodige.
Obviously, he's the continuation. We are violinists. He's the violin is for him. And as the day went by, and the next days arrived, it went worse and worse. And I started getting frustrated with the instrument, taking it in the wrong hand. And so they were like, okay, let's wait. And I was lucky there was a piano at home, and I could play a bit on it. And there's this immediacy on the piano, and first understanding of harmonies, the game of immediately having an equal language. You would see the notes, and every black note had a position on the keys, and so I think I had a logical mind, and I liked things organized, and piano felt the right instrument to start music.
This brings me to this kind of probably ridiculous or very metaphysic notion that you are the Franz Liszt reincarnated. You know, you've come to this world with all the knowledge about the instrument. How does it feel to be dubbed this way? Is it a burden? Is it just funny? Or
no, it was.
Is it true?
Honestly, it felt good at the time because it was very early in my life that it was the review for the Liszt concerto recordings, and I was 17, and I did it with my father, and it was the record that got me then the label Bis to sign with me. So it was no idea that this could work as a career, and to have this American magazine Fanfare at the end of the review say Lister incarnated, it felt extremely good. It was a moment of, okay, this is a recognition,
external
and even
recognition
from another part of the world. Now it feels after all these years, it's done its purpose incredibly well for me, and of course I can't believe in the actual wording of it. I'm happy that the name was on Liszt, because Liszt, I found, is probably the most complete musician that I could think about in terms of curiosity, in terms of really always constantly searching and going forward. And you see the journey he had was huge, from incredible pianist stopping everything to go deep into new techniques on the piano, finding poetic ways to make the pianos be used to tell extra human stories, mm-hmm, with dance, mm-hmm, with hell and heaven, and going more and more impressionism, atonality, everything.
Organ.
Exactly, organ. So this idea of a complete musician, and I'm not a complete musician, so that's why I know this is a big gap. But this is the white idol, I would say, in the musical world.
Great. It's interesting that sometimes especially the French pianists are extremely drawn to German repertoire. I don't know why that is. David Frey.
It's true. Yes.
Alexandre Tarrous.
Yves Nat, Yvonne. Yeah, of course. Yes.
How come? Have you any explanation for that? Because Brahms is your house god, so to speak, and then you have Mathieu, and you have Bach, and of course the Viennese school, and first Viennese school, Mozart, but basically it's the German, Austrian German heritage.
It's true. It's hard to explain why. Probably because of the balance, maybe, of, if I could imagine an answer. If you really, if I say something as basic and stupid as French repertoire was really in the long-term history, you can simplify it as a knowledge of harmonies, mm-hmm, and Russian as turned towards the melody, the German would have a very good balance in between.
Sense of counterpoint and of
yes, this logic, and at the same time just the deepness and the beauty of melodies, but that would really not, in the end, probably not be true. I don't know. It's not even really the love for German repertoire. It was really, it started by the love of Brahms. That's it. And it was by listening to every piece that he touched that he found in a way sort of this balance, I would say, the balance between the head and the heart, between, mm-hmm, the logical past and the advanced future of music, and the dignity that he had in with emotion, always a bit internal, and just a few glimpses of big moments of romantic gestures, but then immediately took back into control. Mm-hmm. All of that made something of a big impression on me, and I still think he's one of the fascinating composers today. Really less extravagant and less immediately recognizable as Liszt, but the advances he made are really significant in music, and I'm really just at the beginning of the journey. I was very concentrated on his first period for the past years, and because I feel that this first period is Brahms at his most extroverted. He's the most ambitious. He's really close to Schumann and Liszt at mm-hmm, this time, mm-hmm, in his big notions, big splashes of painting, of showing whole possibilities of the piano, and it culminated with the first concerto, which is really a monument of experimentation. And then I think this is slowly a moment to think and find the Brahms we mostly tend to think when we think Brahms, with, mm-hmm, this rounded and this control over everything. And definitely still be attracted to that.
You will be also playing Brahms, I mean, tonight, but you will also play Brahms with Theo Hurenz's next year, right, and yes, Utopia Orchestra, Brahms' first piano concerto.
Yeah.
And it's it makes kind of come full circle for the first season, so to speak, because the first appearance of yours was also with Theo Hurenz's in
22 in the Easter time.
I remember.
Slow music.
Yes.
Which was like a very beautiful and a very heavy and somber and delicate concert, I would say. Mm-hmm. It was just a couple of months after Russia invaded Ukraine. And it was all slow movements from concertos from Bach to Ravel, I think.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you were playing this music with this orchestra. And of course, the Fachwelt, you know, the pros knew you already. But it was the first time for you to come here and with this very renowned orchestra and charismatic conductor. And people were just like stunned. Oh, this young guy come from France and he is already in. And then your career kind of took dramatically off, I would say, especially in Hamburg, which happens to be the birthplace of Johannes Brahms, which of course is a total coincidence. But you have been playing here, I don't know, 5 times meanwhile.
I know, a lot. I'm happy. It's a beautiful hall and it's a sort of tower of music. It's an incredible place. And yes, to start with this concert is peculiar because it's really a very unique concert and not at all what I usually do. I'm much more in a traditional format of classical concerts, but there's something with this with Theodor Koenzis where it's very enjoyable to let yourself go and let yourself carried by his ideas, and this something of theater, something of finding connections in a different way, finding different sounds. It's a real care of a game of how far we can go into this idea. And it's something we don't have often the time to do because we generally have a very tight schedule with concertos especially. And I like the amount of time and dedication he spent on every concerto we've done together. It was really nearly a week of preparation. And it's fun to realize how much connection and how much light an orchestra can be and flexible you can enter, because normally with little amounts there's always an inertia and there's always a bit of a mystery of what you can do on stage, and you lose it in this much time. So
yeah, there's a kind of an intimacy almost you know, between the musicians and him, and then the someone's coming in, and that makes sense because the result just speaks for itself. Mm-hmm. You know,
and it was also the personal pleasure of it. The piano was inside the orchestra without a lid, and so you had the sound coming from behind and around you, surrounding you.
Enveloped somehow.
Yes. It's new ideas, and I felt that they had something really meaningful. I think they were worth putting out for an audience, and at the same time, they were rewarding for me, so I was happy.
Yeah. No, it was really something. And I mean, he always does this, you know? He always transcends the ordinary and the way he communicates also with the audience, and it's something special. So tonight you're going to play in the Grand Hall your solo recital.
That's right, yes.
I don't know, a good year after you did it in the recital
in the small hall. Yes, absolutely.
As one of the fast lane artists. You know, we tend to dub fast lane as young artists on the doubling lane, you know, in the freeway, and but it also has this competitive notion about it, which we maybe even don't like that much, because you know, once you play in this on this level, it's not about competition anymore. It's just about awe and wonder and celebrating.
The only competition generally people have is with themselves. It's how it's interesting to see where they go, what they do. But this it's true. You're absolutely right. There's a certain point where it's interesting to hear their world. It's in a totally separated world than another pianist and another musician. And you don't come to compare to the recording you know about a piece. You just come to see what they have in mind, what they have prepared, and I find that beautiful to have this as many varieties possible and as many sounds as possible. And that's why great pieces of music that we listen all the time are still meaningful, because they support and they support all these ideas and all these ways of seeing a work. And the more we have different versions of our work and different emanations of light of our work, the more we get a picture and in a more emotional way. So there's a mental thing that we get, and the work suddenly becomes even more. It becomes a sort of big tentacular piece that connects to it so much. And I think that's the only way to make music. It's really just...
And one has to add that, of course, in your own development, the way you play the pieces will never be the same.
No.
Even though, I mean, the score is fixed and everything, but you keep changing. I have seen this wonderful, like very beautiful video that came to me on somehow secret ways, where you were studying with Daniel Barenboim, the very same Beethoven 2-2 sonata that you played in Moscow.
Absolutely, yes.
And I was wondering, I mean, that must have been like 4 or 5 years gap between Moscow and this tutorial with Daniel Barenboim.
2 years.
Two years.
Yeah, yeah, one or 2 years, yeah. It was quite often.
21 or 22 during COVID.
Exactly, so, yeah. Yes.
I find this totally fascinating because, and I can't marvel enough about it, and it's unfair because people can't really watch it, but it's the way he I wouldn't say he teaches you. In ways, he suggests things. Mm-hmm. He plays everything half your tempo at least, but the expression and what he does with the music and how you interact is precious, I find.
He's really a precious person. He's really a portal of the past. He's one of the gatekeepers of some kind of knowledge and some direct contact with some composers, with some interprets that are lost since the beginning of the century. I mean, he played when he was 11 with Fort Wangler. He has still all these stories and all these ways of how music felt, and some timings and some sounds that he heard are still there with him. So you feel like you're just in this 1 hour or two of music, you just scratch the surface of hugely dense life of music. And I'm really happy I did it. And this beautiful way, like you said, a supporting way of trying to understand what you want, of finding a way so that you would be more efficient at doing it, having some huge experience about these works. And so in a way, it's like he looks at you from very far in the path, that and you're still there, and he just points you, like, if you go just a little bit to your right, you're on the right path somehow to this piece, and you'll understand maybe later or some of the things. And no, it's someone that I'm really grateful that I had this contact.
It's probably not that easy to quantify this in any way, but did any of this really stick with you, and did it change your approach to this sonata and to Beethoven in general? Yeah.
Very much so. Yeah. I mean, there was especially, I think, the how he would imagine legato. He
just, exactly.
In the end, he just said a few phrases that really stuck, of the way, just it's about
how the wrist moves.
Exactly, about the wrist, and just these subtle things that they seem a bit significant because they're just so concrete, and they felt that they can't have a lot of deepness associated with them, but for a reason these are the ones that stick. And I still think about that now in lots of phrases. I think he relates very well how after you attack a note, basically what you do is pointless on trying to change the notes you've just played. So it's this feeling that can only happen with the feet and the pedal. So it's more about how you will prepare with your wrist the next note, and that's how you create the illusion. And sometimes when you're really carried with the music, you put a lot of intensity even after playing the notes. And that's a very good tip to just
to practice, or to just incorporate this somehow in the practicing process. The quick jump back, I mean, working with your father, he was, I think, 52 or so when you were born. So there's quite a difference in age.
Was really 52?
I think he was born in 45.
Oh, yeah, that's right, 45. Yeah. Wow.
So the fact that you don't notice is a good sign.
He's a very young man.
So he wouldn't be like the old father trying to overpower you in a way. But how was it really working musically with him? Was it? Did you still feel free, or would he try to direct you in certain ways?
No. They were very free parents. They didn't actually imagine too much that this was going to be my career or profession. I would say they had the will to whatever I would do. I had to make it right, and I had to be, I would say, ready to put the hours and to put the work into whatever I would do. So they were committed on kind of discipline of work every day. But it wasn't at all sure about music, so they would leave me pretty much on my own with my teachers. And I was like a lot of kids always saying, no, it's my teacher will say how I play when I was.
You can't
say what. But I remember distinctly when my father he was. Coming from home from concerts, he would suddenly listen to a little. He would just say one or two things, and I just put little ideas, put things, and I just maybe do that, or you should maybe try like that. And for a while, it was like that. And slowly, as it became more and more clear that it was going to be piano who would be defining the rest of my life, then they went much more close and they listened more and more and really committed to what I was doing. And I really felt, yes, well, my high time in high school where it was the first beginnings of concerts with the high school orchestra, the adrenaline that made me realize how much it was meaningful. Mm-hmm. So it went slowly, but I think compared to a lot of musical families, they kept really a big distance from that. I didn't know a lot of the musical figures in our world at the time. I knew a lot of music by listening to it because we would listen constantly, but I didn't have really notions of who they were, or even the composers. So all of that came in a bit of a delay, and I had to gobble up a lot of things afterwards. So I felt, yeah, music was instilled really in an instinctive way more than a clear and conscious way.
So that you would have had kind of a ordinary childhood also
together with that. Oh, we were a bit remote in a small suburban town, normal school. Until high school, it was still a possibility for me going into science. I was more like, I said, it was quite a logical kid, so it felt
so
that this was a
possibility. What science attracted you most?
Physics, yeah, astrophysics, something like that. I would imagine that would be the things I used to read about and I really cared about. And it had enough of a logical mind and a bit of mystique, a bit of unknown that I craved for, I think. And
the vastness of the universe or
something like that. Yes. Okay. And it stuck for a while, and that's why really it came only thanks to other friends of my age who were musicians, where I really had a musical community for the first time and realized much more how much I liked this feeling and this world. And then after high school, didn't look really back onto other possibilities in my life. And since then, it's been really just a continuation of that every day, it feels.
You enchanted the audience when you were playing here 10 days ago with Münchener Philharmoniker and Tugan Sokiev. You did this very smash Rachmaninoff thing, the variations on the Paganini motive or theme, and then as an encore you play Danny Boy.
That's right.
And everybody was like, I think people were recognizing it somehow remotely, but from totally different contexts. So no classical pianist normally would probably play this. And it's not an easy piece, not at all. It's very emotional. And you played a very, it felt like a long and complex and very inward version of it. And I can't help it, but I was thinking of Keith Jarrett because it's part of his repertoire. He loves playing it. And I was wondering, did you hear him
do this? Yes, of course. This was the actually main complete idea. It was his version that I did. And I really loved exactly what you said, the inward quality of it. I think it's the Tokyo version that I did. And yes, it's a profound piece, and more and more, it's not really a unique thing. A lot of classical pianists I know, they go into jazz and encores, and with this Rachmaninoff piece written and played in LA, with you see the jazz influences, even if
absolutely
it's still the melancholy and the Russian soul, but you really see the fanfares of brass, you
off
see
beats,
the
stuff coming on,
yes, yeah. And the tight. The shortness of the orchestration, everything you know, there's an American influence, and that's why I felt it didn't feel too out of place to play this work. And it's I'm sad that I don't have the capacity, and I didn't take the time when I was little to really improvise. So I, for now, find a bit of creativity by just trying to reproduce and listen to some improvisations and trying to redo them, maybe one day transcribe a bit, even symphonies or parts like that. But I feel that would be the extent of my creativity. So for now, I can just enjoy
this. So
that
means pleasure. You did the transcription of Keith's piece yourself?
I had a basis of the chords, the harmonies he did, and then it was by ear, and I did that with Nina Simone, also with Saint-Saëns opera she did in Saint-Saëns and Dalila. She did in Carnegie Hall. She played that, and also there's no score, but I just played her version by ear. It's not much, but it's a little moment where you expand a little bit what you are used to do, and we'll see. Maybe one day it will take me somewhere further, but for now it's the extent of what I am capable of doing as more creative.
Yeah. It might sound a little brutal to come from Keith Jarrett now to this Chaconne that you're going to perform tonight, which is only for the left hand, the Brahms version of mm-hmm. the Bach Chaconne. You've put this at the ending of your solo concert mm-hmm. tonight. Does it need any big special preparation to be able to play these almost 15 minutes left-handed counterpoint music that's so intricate and beautiful?
Well, I don't know, but I feel there's no other possibility to play set at the end. I mean, if you even look at the partita, it's the end of the partita, it's the end of the journey. And mm-hmm. I feel that Brahms, even if it feels so simple, he just put the same texts mm-hmm. and put it at the left hand, but it does so much to recapture the spirits and the intimacy, the tightness, the simplicity, the universality of this music. And it felt something meaningful after this whole journey, which goes quite in complex territory harmonically, really, at the end with Bartok Rhapsody, with Rachmaninoff's First Sonata, that is sprawling and that is really, really a dense work of complexity, these psychology Faustian characters with a lot of counterpoints. I felt that in the end, having the simplicity and the purity of one line was probably needed, and it felt natural to me. And I think it's often the moment that I really look forward into recital, the moment where it's like just this, the fog that disappears.
And okay. Now you come to the utmost clarity of it, and just even with the letting go of the right hand and just playing it with the left hand.
Really. So what's difficult is after that, if this encore is going back to the right hand, because the right hand just feels that it's over.
It's done for today.
It's
so
done, yes.
And you have to call it back into just in case anybody would want an encore.
Exactly.
So Alexander, I thank you really very much.
It was thank you.
Great pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, me too.
And I wish you all the best for tonight and for the future and for many coming backs of yours into our hall during this upcoming season.
Yeah, well, all the best.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.